Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on New FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. My guest on the show today is author and historian John Foote. John is the author of several books focusing on Italy. His most recent book is entitled Blood and Power, The Rise of Italian Fascism. And I'm delighted to say that John is joining us on the line. John, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Pleasure. Nice to meet you, Patrick.
So, John, I'd suggest it's your most recent book is about Italian fascism, the rise and fall. It's a very timely time for the book to come out, given the recent election in Italy, and given that just a few days ago we had the 100th anniversary of the March on Rome. So it is a very, very timely book.
Yes, I mean, I started work on it sort of 3 or 4 years ago, and it didn't seem quite so timely then. But with the election of Giorgia Meloni, with all the things that are going on in Italy, it becomes sort of very topical, problematic. And there's also tons of books and stuff coming out about fascism. So there's a lot of discussion, which is really interesting, and it's very political and very current.
Yeah, and with Mussolini was the first fascist leader to come in power, would it be too simplistic to say that without Mussolini's seizing power 100 years ago, you wouldn't have had the subsequent election or the seizing of power of Adolf Hitler?
I think it's not simplistic at all. Hitler copied a lot of what had happened in Italy even before the March on Rome. He was inspired by, you know, Italy invented fascism. Mussolini's movement was the first to call itself that, to kind of mix up extreme nationalism, elements of socialism, and violence altogether. And Hitler tried to copy that failed a few times, as in the 1923 sort of beer hall putsch, which is a kind of copy of the March on Rome, but didn't work. And then eventually the coming to power, and when they work very closely together once he was in power. So I think, yes, without the March on Rome, you probably don't get the rise of Hitler to power, and you probably don't get the Second World War. So it's a pretty big moment.
Yeah, and you document in your book how divided Italy was. There was a big divide between the left and the right in Italy at the time. Would it be, it seemed to me, just reading your book, Mussolini's, and you document when he fell from power, he didn't seem to have, even though he gained power, he didn't seem to have popular support amongst ordinary Italians. Like when you mention in the book, when he ultimately was executed, there was much celebrations when he was deposed.
Yeah, I think it varies over the period of the regime. I think there's probably in the 30s, there's a moment of kind of maximum, what people in Italy often call consensus. Of course, it's a dictatorship, so it's hard to tell. But I think with that period in the mid-30s, there is a certain kind of support or acceptance. Once Italy enters the Second World War, that goes very rapidly wrong, and all of that falls away. And by the time that he's deposed and then shot by partisans, he's almost universally unpopular amongst from a very tiny fringe. And when they took power, they were definitely a minority. They only got a majority in parliament through violence and election rigging. They never got anything over about 30 MPs in any popular election. So they were never a majority movement. They always used violence to get their way.
Yeah, and of course there was a few assassination attempts on Mussolini, and interestingly, one of the nearest assassination attempts was an Irish woman, Violet Gibson, and it's a story that's in the news in Ireland at the moment, because there was a plaque unveiled recently where Violet was born. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about Violet Gibson and her attempt on the life of Mussolini, and how close she actually got to killing him?
It's an amazing story, and there's been some fantastic books, including one by Frances Stoner Saunders that I think is really, really good. It's sort of a very strange story. She moved to Italy, and it's not quite clear why or what she was doing, but she certainly was politically interested in Mussolini and had been to see the trial of the killers of a socialist called Giacomo Matteotti, who was killed by fascists in Rome in a very famous murder in 1924. And then she sort of got very close to Mussolini. I mean, physically, had a gun, had a rock in her pocket, which she was apparently going to use to smash a car window if that had happened, and shot at Mussolini from very close round and missed him by, well, she hit his nose, but, you know, missed killing him by nothing, and was then arrested. And it's a terribly sad story because politically, what they did was they didn't want a trial because that was very politically sensitive. And they sort of decided she was mad, got some psychiatrists to kind of write reports saying she was deranged and so on. And then shut her in an asylum for the rest of her life in England, and never came, and then she never got out. And it's a terribly tragic story. And he used the assassination attempt to clamp down further on internal dissent.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, just prior to going out to conduct this interview, there's just as a kind of an aside, there was letters in the Irish Times this morning just disputing, just saying that this plaque should not be up, that that she wasn't an anti-fascist. So it's kind of interesting, and even I think there's a documentary in Dublin this week, so it's kind of interesting that her story is becoming more prominent. And I suppose it's with the 100th anniversary, with the rise of Mussolini, it is interesting to say.
Yeah, I think she's come back into prominence in Ireland in recent years, and I think that's very interesting. I mean, the evidence is a bit, you know, we don't know for sure why she did it, but I mean, why did someone, she had sort of mental health problems, that's for sure. Why would someone try and kill Mussolini at that time? You'd think there was politics involved, but we don't know for sure. Yeah. Whatever happened, you know, her life was really, really horrible after that.
Yeah, no, it is, as you said, it's an incredibly sad story. Might go on to sport, because I know I recently read your book about the history of Italian football, probably the definitive English kind of, in the English language, the definitive account of Italian football. And we have a World Cup coming up that is very controversial, to say the least. And Mussolini used the 1934 World Cup to increase his power. He did seem to... Was he a football fan, or did he just see sport as a way of gaining more support?
I don't think he was particularly interested in football. He pretended to be a Lazio fan. I think he wasn't. He used to go to a few games, but what he understood was the power of sport, and what his regime understood was the power of sport to cement consensus amongst people, particularly football. They put a lot of money into football and built a lot of stadiums and a lot of money into the national team, and also other sports like cycling. So they understood that, and in fact the staging of 34 World Cup was one of the first times that a dictatorship had used a tournament to gain consensus. Very topical. Yeah. and happened quite a few times since, not least 78 Argentina, Russia, various other times, dictatorships have understood the need, you know, the usefulness of organizing a tournament at home. And you know, they organized it with set piece events and won it, of course, which helps. They also won in 38 and the Olympic football tournament in 36. So you could say Italy under fascism was a very, very good football team, probably the best in the world.
Yeah. And just bringing it up to more recent times. You mentioned at the introduction of your book that Liam Brady, who's not far from where we're recording this interview, where he grew up, he was your favourite footballer, and he broke your heart when he left Arsenal. What was it about Liam Brady that you loved so much?
Well, I grew up an Arsenal fan. I grew up in going to see Arsenal on the North Bank in at Highbury. And I saw him, you know, as a teenager, and just a genius, you know, to see him live. And he left us so young, you know. He was one of the first big foreign stars to go to Italy. I mean, that time you could only have three foreigners in your team. And I think he replaced, or was replaced by Platini, and the other way, I can't remember which round it was, way round it was, Maradona was the round at that time. You know, it was an amazing series of foreigners, and he was as good as them. But it was very sad, I think, for all Arsenal fans when he left, and we all thought he would come back, and then he came back to West Ham, which was not quite as good as we expected. But he was a genius. I've never seen anyone as good as that, I don't think.
Yeah.
And that kind of, it piqued my interest in Italian football already as a young boy, and later on I wrote about it. And he had a very good reputation in Italy. You know, he didn't play that long for Juve because there was this restriction, but he won a championship taking a penalty in the last game, super cool kind of penalty, and he was well remembered by the fans of the teams he played for.
Yeah, and it was you moved over to Italy in the early 90s, and it must have been a great period to be over there, because you mentioned in your book, I don't know what you mentioned in the book, or it was an interview I was reading, you're an Inter fan, and Inter just won the title when you moved over, and then you had the great AC Milan team. So it must have been a golden period to be over in Italy.
Yeah, I suppose in some ways I didn't really realise how good that league was when I moved. I moved there in the sort of late 80s, and I saw the 90 World Cup and the kind of boom around that as well. I was in Milan for the sort of opening games and that tournament. But yes, the quality of player in Serie A when I was there was just extraordinary. You know, Van Basten, Maradona, Platini was just finished, I think. You know, it was just, and that was them. Then there was all the Italians, which you could just reel off. That Milan team, which I saw play, which I've written about, and the stadiums and the crowds, and it was just an amazing. To some extent, I hadn't quite realised it. It was also gold dust from the point of view of a historian, because we had this guy called Silvio Berlusconi who came along and became prime minister, but was also owner of Milan, and that combination of sporting power, political power, was just never been seen before, and I don't think it's ever been seen since, actually, and that conflict of interest. So that was just great material to write about how politics and football were intertwined so much in Italy, and kind of affected each other all the time, right through the 90s. And of course, Berlusconi's still around. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's propping up the government now, and just as controversial as he was in 94. And in some ways, just to finish that, I think it's the beginning of the populism, which we can see everywhere now, was Berlusconi's first election in 94. I mean, all the people across the world who've been elected since kind of owe a debt in some extent to his model.
Yeah, and you mentioned Berlusconi, and he's in government at present. What is your view of the you mentioned at the start Meloni, the first far right leader since Mussolini was in charge? Are you pessimistic about her? She's recently taken power. Do you think she will moderate? Like, she has in the past expressed some very extreme views. Do you think now that she's in power, she might moderate her views, or the fact that it is quite a right-wing government, that it is a kind of a fearful time for Italy?
It's a very right-wing government. It's the most right-wing government Italy has had in a democracy. And some of the views are pretty extreme amongst ministers, institutional figures. Meloni has had to be more moderate to get elected. I think if she'd stayed in her ghetto of sort of neo-fascist ghetto, she would have got, you know, 5-10%. So she's had to appeal to a much wider electorate. I think the signs are not great from a whole series of points of view. Dysfunctionality, the government has already looks pretty dysfunctional and divided. A lot of problematic foreign policy pronouncements about the war in Ukraine. They're not fascist. They're not going to abolish democracy. They're not going to march on Rome. They've already taken power, and they're operating within democratic rules. But I think on many things to do with rights and to do with, for example, LGBT rights and abortion rights, there are lots of problematic signs, as there are in many governments across the world. So I'm not going to say, I think it's silly to say Meloni's a fascist. A lot of her followers, you know, have nostalgia for the regime, but they've also operated within the democracy. So I think we should call out all of the nostalgia and all of the bad history, but we should also politically engage and try and take them on politically, as opposed to just calling them fascists, which doesn't really get you anywhere.
Mm. And it's remarkable, like you mentioned in your book, like that's why I really enjoyed the book, because there is an attempt to kind of, I don't know whether rehabilitate Mussolini's image is too strong of a term, but what I found remarkable that the place of Mussolini's death is a pilgrimage even to this day, and recently a lot of people visit there. Like it just seems absolutely remarkable that a place like that would be such a pilgrimage site.
It's tolerated. I think the problem is it's been tolerated for so long, and these people have been dismissed as nostalgic people who are a bit silly and like dressing up, like sort of fancy dress. But you know, this is the tomb of a dictator who most estimates think that his actions led to the premature deaths of about 1 million people. So it's kind of like detaching what he did from this kind of nostalgic idea that he was sort of somewhat benign. And I think it's very problematic. I mean, Spain is a good example for action. You know, Spain, Franco built this hideous thing called the Valley of the Fallen, which, you know, you could dynamite, I suppose, but they have actually removed his body from there now. And so if you're making a pilgrimage as a fascist there, you're not going to, his body's not there, it's gone back to the family area. Problem with Mussolini's area, it's the kind of mixture of family and politics. But yeah, I think those people should not be allowed to do that. It should be against the law, and there are laws on the statute book about fascism, but they're just not applied. And I think it's very dangerous, because it's a normalization of that regime. It's not the message that should be sent out.
Yeah, well, as I say, that's why I think books like yourself that you've written are just so important, because it kind of documents the regime and how oppressive and how horrible a regime it was. Before I wrap up, John, I might take it back to the modern day. The Italian League at the moment, we have Napoli on top and Atlanta second. So it seems to be quite an exciting, and it would be a remarkable story. People that follow English football would have seen Napoli, a fantastic performance against Liverpool. They seem to be flying now. What's your view on the, do they have enough to win the title this year?
They've come so close a few times in recent years, and I think it would be so good for the Italian league if a southern team won again. Napoli have only won it twice, both with Maradona, and I think it would just be great for, you know, the balance of the league and for Napoli itself, and it would be a great party. You know, everyone should get a plane over there if Napoli win the Scudetto. But I think it's a very open league, and it's a very entertaining league, and the sort of association of Italian football with defensive football is kind of long gone. It doesn't get the very best players, but a lot of players who are on their way to becoming the best go through Italy and then come on to perhaps the Premiership or the Liga. So you can see some stars. Osimhen, who plays for Napoli, is going to be a massive star. So it's really fun to watch, I think, and the technical level is still very high. And of course, the national team is such a roller coaster. Won the Euros, then lost to North Macedonia in the knockout of the bloody World Cup. So they're not going to be in Qatar, which is probably a good World Cup to miss. But nonetheless, this up and down nature of the national team is something which is very sort of good material again for me, but problematic from they've missed the last two World Cups, which for Italy is a big thing, but won the Euros in the middle, and would you take that? So I think, and they're kind of rebuilding again, so I think they'll be good again. But it's an interesting league to watch, and it's a bit off the radar for many people.
Yeah, and would it like you've spent a lot of time in Italy. Do you think Italian people are more passionate about their football than it than say in England?
I think it's more all-encompassing there. It certainly was in the past. It would kind of dominate. I mean, it's kind of developed like that in England and the Britain over the last few years. But I think I noticed that kind of all-encompassing nature of being a fan was very powerful in Italy. And we have the kind of crazy things happen in Italy, which are still sort of, absolutely mad. Like last weekend, one of the head of the Inter organized fans, the ultra, was shot dead on the edge of Milan, and he'd been in prison a lot of times for drug dealing, and the whole end where the hardcore fans stand forced everybody there to leave the stadium in honor of this guy who'd been shot dead. I mean, what is going on there? And there's been a huge controversy over it. So there's always this mixture of the society, politics, and football in Italy, which is very, very powerful. It's never just a game there.
Yeah, well, I people that are interested, I highly recommend your book on Italian football. As you say, like it's football and society and politics, as we see coming up in the World Cup in Qatar, they do very much mix. So that's really, really recommended. John, thanks so much for taking the time to take our call today. It was fascinating. I think we covered everything. We just covered football, politics. I think we covered a lot of ground in the course of a chat. Your most recent book, Blood and Power: The Rise and Fall of Italian Fascism. It's available now in all good bookshops, and people give you a follow, I guess, in social media, and they will get all the details of your previous books. I know you've a book about Italian cycling and loads of other Italian related content. So, John, thanks so much for taking the time to take our call today.
Thank you, Patrick. I really enjoyed that.
That was great. That was John Foote joining us to chat about his most recent book, Blood and Power: The Rise and Fall of Italian Fascism.